Welcome to Gravity, a podcast on the environment and human rights issues from the local to the global. In many languages, when we refer to our planet, we refer to the ground. Earth, la terra, la terre, земля, die Erde, Arbon, to name just a few. Our languages, the structures of our thought, disclose our terrestrial mindset. What we call Earth is 71% ocean. The ocean is a whopping 95% of our biosphere. Over half of the world's coral is found in the deep sea. Over 10 million known species inhabit it, and we are still finding new species. Life first formed in the ocean, in the deep sea hydrothermal vents, and land itself is largely derived from submarine tectonic and magmatic activity. We all came from the sea, and we continue to be deeply connected to the deep sea. The ocean is the world's greatest carbon sink, and its currents regulate our climate. The deep sea circulates nutrients essential for the marine food web and sustains the marine food we eat. This environment is the lifeblood of our planet, and it's fragile. The extremophiles that inhabit this environment rely on a very different and stable environment that we continually encroach upon to their detriment and our own. The deep sea is in deep trouble. Anthropogenic climate change is increasing acidification and spreading hypoxia. The Atlantic meridional overturning circulation has displayed definitive signs of weakening. And I, for one, am none too at ease that scientists hold medium confidence that it will not collapse in the coming decades. The collapse of this critical current is a climate tipping point, flipping seasons, increasing sea level, and leading to severe cooling in the Northern Hemisphere. Our efforts to mitigate climate change are also threatening the deep sea. Geoengineering solutions to increase the carbon uptake, inject and sequester carbon in the seafloor, or separate carbon through electric currents have known and unknown risks. And we must take a precautionary approach before we may ironically weaken our strongest carbon sink by attempting to strengthen it. Then there's the inaptly named renewable energy transition, which relies on rapacious extraction of critical elements, of which mining is causing sacrifice zones across the world. One such sacrifice zone may be the deep sea. The seabed contains polymetallic nodules that contain cobalt and other transition elements. We are still exploring the deep sea. There is so much that we do not know. Are we to insouciantly extract and risk irreparable damage to this environment and the habitat of long-living endemic species? The penultimate question of our time is how we mitigate climate change, our mistake, without repeating our prior mistakes. To not batter our planet for batteries. We must see the preservation of biodiversity and the mitigation of climate change as one integrated problem that demands a holistic solution. Are we to survive by the sacrifice of some? And if so, who gets to decide who gets sacrificed? Surely we can do better. We must do better. I spoke to Matthew Jani, the co-founder and political and policy advisor to the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, on the importance of the deep sea, the key threats to the deep sea, and efforts to preserve it. Welcome to Gravity, Matt.
Well, thank you, Alexandra. I'm happy to be here.
So you are the co-founder and the political and policy advisor to the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. Can you tell our audience, please, what the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition is and what you've been doing for the past 20 years there? And by the way, happy 20th anniversary.
Thank you. Yeah. No, we've been, around for, like you say, 20 years. We're celebrating our 20th year anniversary. It's a coalition of organizations from around the world, environmental organizations, but also, for example, parliamentarians, legal and policy institutes, some fishing industry associations, primarily on the small scale side of things. And we started 20 years ago to campaign to put an end to deep water bottom trawl fishing on the high seas. And took that campaign to the United Nations General Assembly as a kind of the overarching body looking after policies and fisheries, for example, as well as deep sea bed mining and other issues in areas beyond national jurisdiction, about half of the ocean that lies beyond the 200-mile zones, the areas of national jurisdiction of coastal states like the United States and others. And it's about two-thirds of the world's ocean and about half the surface of the planet. So we're talking about a very big part of our Earth. And we campaigned at the United Nations General Assembly or through a General Assembly process. We managed to get working with governments, sympathetic governments, scientists, and others, the UN General Assembly to call for action to prohibit deep sea trawling on deep water coral ecosystems and sponge ecosystems and other sorts of ecosystems in the deep sea that in some cases are formed by habitats like, contain habitats formed like by deep water corals, for example, that may live thousands of years, or deep water sponges that can live over 10,000 years. Animals that form these habitats that in turn contain a whole range of different species, sometimes endemic and rare species, and species that are highly vulnerable to the impact of these several tons of heavy fishing gear that scrape across the ocean bottom to catch fish. And I know a bit about all this and because prior to my time working as an environmental activist, or at least as an environmental activist with the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, and previous to that, running the Greenpeace International Oceans Campaign, I was a commercial fisherman myself for 10 years. Including 5 years working on a deep sea trawler off the coast of Central California.
That's fascinating. So you started in commercial fishing. You saw how terrible it was for the environment, and then you decided to fight for the environment and try and ban this indiscriminate fishing practice.
Well, yes and no. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. I worked in a whole variety of different fisheries. I worked 10 years as a commercial fisherman, including 5 years on an offshore trawler along the Central California coast. But I did Dungeness crab fishing up out of Crescent City, California, hook and line for salmon out of Newport, Oregon. I did deep sea scalloping off the New England coast, gillnet fishing for mackerel off the Florida coast, and a variety of other things. And, you know, some fisheries are quite well-managed, sustainable, sometimes community-based, like the Crescent City, California, Dungeness crab fishery, one of my favorite at the time, and relatively clean, very little bycatch, very little impact on the ecosystem, whether it's the, you know, the seafloor ecosystems or the pelagic ecosystems, etc. And so I actually got involved in environmental activism as a fisherman, together with others, primarily from Half Moon Bay, California, to fight a big dredge disposal project off the Central California coast. And this was in 1988. And this was a project that was 5 years in the making. It had funding from U.S. Congress, the American President Lines, the Port of Oakland, California. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was involved. The EPA had authorized it or okayed it, given its approval. And we only found out about this project and the fact that they were going to dump something like 5.4 million metric tons of dredge disposal off the coast of Half Moon Bay about 2 months before the project was to begin. Wow. And so we decided to fight it as fishermen. We did an at-sea blockade. We organized some legal actions. One of the fishermen there in Half Moon Bay took a whole big pickup truckload full of rotting fish carcasses and dumped them onto the front porch of the offices of the Port of Oakland, California. And apparently was almost immediately arrested and then immediately let go. But by then he had been interviewed by the press. The press got word of it and so forth. The long and short of this was we won. And I thought at the time, I saw at the time the power of people in the fishing industry to, you know, work to protect their fishing grounds from pollution and offshore oil and gas exploration and so forth. And so I decided to join an environment organization to kind of continue to pursue that line of work.
Fantastic.
But ultimately, there are some types of fishing that are not particularly sustainable and can be hugely damaging to the marine environment. And deep water trawling, going down to 1,000 meters, 15 meters depth in areas where life grows in the slow lane. These species, whether they're species of fish, for example, Greenland sharks can live to over 400 years old. Orange roughfish species that's sold in U.S. supermarkets, but is caught by New Zealand vessels in the South Pacific on seamounts, can live to over 200 years. And sometimes the industry calls these older fish Napoleons because they were alive during the Battle of Waterloo, basically. And these types of species, plus the ecosystems that they inhabited, are hugely vulnerable, highly vulnerable to damage, and in many cases are very slow to recover, if they recover at all. And these are highly biologically diverse ecosystems. They're unique ecosystems. And so, for example, in this case, I decided back in the early 2000s, let's try to pull together a coalition to take this issue to the United Nations General Assembly and see if we could get these the General Assembly to commit states, you know, the high seas fishing nations in particular, to basically stop trawling on these vulnerable deep sea ecosystems. And we got the resolutions adopted by the General Assembly, a whole series of resolutions, but we're still working on getting states and the regulatory bodies that manage high seas fisheries to actually fully implement the commitments that they've made through the United Nations General Assembly. So, for example, I've just gotten back from Tokyo, where there is a meeting of the North Pacific Fisheries Commission. It's the body formed by Canada, the U.S., Russia, Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, or Chinese Taipei, and Vanuatu, regulating high seas fisheries in the North Pacific. And big debate. The U.S. has a very strong proposal on the table, consistent with what everybody's agreed to do already through the U.N. General Assembly resolutions. But Japan is basically saying, no, we want to keep fishing on these seamounts, we want to keep trawling on these seamounts, and we do not accept that we're actually doing any damage, in spite of the fact that, you know, when you see the visual surveys coming out of these areas of these trawl scars across bare rock where corals used to grow, you realize, yes, there is damage and it continues to be happening. And somehow this political impasse has to be broken.
So for some of our audience that don't understand what trawling is, I mean, it's a very indiscriminate method. Can you explain how it works?
Well, basically, it's dragging a heavy net along the ocean bottom to catch everything above a certain size. And the bigger the trawls, or the big trawls, the deep water trawls, tend to be quite heavy and quite robustly built to be able to trawl over rocks and in areas where, for example, you couldn't actually trawl with the coastal type of trawl net or a trawl gear that is built for sandy bottom or muddy bottom or, you know, ocean bottom that doesn't have a lot of rocks and crags and canyons and so forth and so on. And, you know, not all trawling is necessarily bad. I mean, it depends on where you're doing the fishing, but the deep water trawling is almost universally impactful damaging to deep water ecosystems. And there are some kinds of things we used to bring up off the Central California coast, which just I found really quite interesting when I was a fisherman. I had no idea what they were, but they're so-called glass sponges. Hexahalidae is the scientific name, or for the taxonomic group. And they almost break apart in your hands when little bits and pieces come up. But these are organisms that actually live, in some cases, for over 10,000 years. And they are highly vulnerable to trawl damage. And when we would see them in the nets, we would basically be seeing small fragments of these so-called fields or aggregations of these sponges that were probably quite more abundant than the actual bits and pieces that we bring up in the nets. and may have never recovered from the impact of the trawling that we did. And the same is true for trawling elsewhere in the deep sea where these types of organisms grow.
So with trawling, because it's so indiscriminate, you get a lot of bycatch. So then it's just thrown away and wasted. And then you're also disrupting the seafloor and possibly disrupting nutrients.
Well, there's some interesting study. Well, first of all, yes, you're disrupting the seafloor. And ironically, you're disrupting the habitat that the fish you're trying to catch depend on. And so it's actually detrimental to the fishery itself. The trawling, again, depending on where you trawl, but for in many, many cases, you get a lot of bycatch, which you can't sell because there's no market for it. Mm-hmm. Or because you're catching a variety of different species, you may be getting bycatch of species with commercial value, but you've gone over quota on those, but you still catch those species while you're pursuing other species. You know, we used to catch probably 30 or 40 different species on a typical 4 or 5 day trip trawling. And we might throw over the side 20 or 30% of the catch because we couldn't sell it, or some of the fish were too small to sell, or although the adults were of commercial value, or we've gone over quota on some of the species that we were catching, but we could still had a quota to catch the rest and so forth and so on. But the damage at the bottom occurs. And there was a third question you asked about this. Oh, and stirring up the sediments and so forth. Yeah. There have actually been some very interesting studies, including one that was published a couple of years ago, that stirring up these sediments releases carbon that's been sequestered into those sediments that can basically go back into the atmosphere, can be brought back up to the surface through upwelling. And you know, it in effect degrades the carbon sequestration value of the sediments that are trawled in the ocean overall. And one of the things that scientists have concluded is that the oceans absorb about 25% of the carbon dioxide that we pump into the atmosphere. And so it's an extraordinarily important carbon sink, natural carbon sink. And to interrupt that and to degrade the ability of the ocean, including by sequestering the carbon and locking it away into the sediments by trawling and mixing these sediments back up, is detrimental to our future in terms of efforts to fight climate change.
Yeah, and it's all interrelated, isn't it? You've got climate change coming from our actions, and then we're intensifying climate change through other actions. And then we're going to talk later about geoengineering solutions with respect to expanding the capacity of the ocean to sequester carbon, but that might actually cause another catastrophe. If we don't have a holistic approach, I think we're going to be in a lot of trouble. But before we go into these questions, I want to discuss the importance of the deep sea and how deeply connected we are to the deep sea. Because when we talk about our planet, if we look at our planet, it's a blue planet. 3/4 of our planet is ocean. And yet in a lot of languages, when we talk about the earth, we connect it to the land where we live because we're humans and we live on the land. So you've got earth, terra, la terre, zemlya in Russian and Serbo-Croatian and other Slavonic languages. And so I think even in Norwegian, Scandinavian languages, it's okay. I'm going to brutally pronounce it, but I think it's yolu or like it's soil. It's the same word as soil. Yeah. I think it's spelled yod. But anyway, so we just forget how deeply connected we are. We forget that 95% of the Earth's biosphere is actually in the deep sea, and there's over 10 million species, and we're finding new species every day, right?
Yeah, that's right. Every scientific expedition that goes out to explore the deep ocean finds new species, finds species that have not been discovered before, or at least not have not been identified taxonomically or scientifically. Even the species themselves, much less their role in whatever ecosystems that they are found in and live in and help support. It's a fascinating place. I've learned so much about the deep sea. I mean, from fishing, but now since I've been working on deep sea conservation issues. And by the way, the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition now includes over 130 organizations worldwide. So we've actually grown quite a bit since the start of the coalition 20 years ago, with a handful of individuals and organizations coming together to run this campaign, take this campaign to the United Nations General Assembly. But, you know, there are connections between the deep sea and the open ocean. You have, for example, the United Nations First World Ocean Assessment that talks about deep ocean ecosystems are driving planetary processes. You have connections from the surface of the ocean all the way down to the deep sea through animals, for example, like sperm whales that will dive very, very deep. Some even think that certain species of animals can go 3,000 to 4,000 or 5,000 meters or more depth. And then they bring up nutrients from the bottom. They kind of circulate nutrients from deeper ocean waters to surface waters and back down again to deeper waters. And there are a whole suite of species that are migrating back and forth between the deep ocean and the surface waters. And in fact, the largest animal migration on our planet today is the nightly migration of species from the so-called mesopelagic zone, the area from about 200 meters to 1,000 meters depth, up into the surface waters to feed on plankton and small organisms, and then back down again before the sun comes back out or daylight occurs, in order to avoid being themselves eaten by predators. And so you have this massive migration of animals. I mean, to put it in terms of brute weight, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of animals of a whole variety of different species, many of which even in that zone have not yet been discovered, much less the ones even deeper down. But you also have the deep ocean regulating climate. And again, if you mess with this carbon sink, I mean, we need all the help we can get. Natural planetary carbon sequestration processes to survive the next 50 to 100 years of climate change, and before we can hopefully get it right in terms of, you know, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, transitioning to renewable energy economies, and preventing the worst of the impacts of climate change.
Yes, and that is a huge problem for humanity. And one that we're approaching in a very bifurcated way, right? We have an issue with the loss of biodiversity, and then we have an issue with climate change, and we have two different conventions. We have different principles, and a lot of the solutions for mitigating climate change are actually very detrimental to the preservation of biodiversity.
That's right.
And in my opinion, I think we need an integrated, holistic approach, because what is the point of destroying the environment to protect the climate? I mean, just, for us, it's going to be an existential crisis either way. And one of the ways that some people, I mean, the metals company, for instance, wants to save us from this peril of climate change is to catalyze the energy transition by mining the seabed. Now, so we have these, you were just saying that these species live a long time, so they have to wait longer for sexual maturity. They might have less offspring, so they might be more vulnerable. And then we have mining, which probably would be very detrimental not only to the species there, and we don't even know what species, right? Because we're finding so many species every day, but it might be problematic for our sequestering of carbon. And also, there was a paper recently that these polymetallic nodules that contain the nickel and the cobalt and all these critical minerals that we want for the energy transition, that they might actually be producing oxygen.
That was a startling find. It still has to be validated by other, you know, repeat experiments and so forth and so on. But the big question is, how important is two big questions come up. How important is this to the functioning of deep sea ecosystems? And number two, after 40 years of pretty intensive research by companies and countries that are interested in mining the deep ocean, they've only just discovered this now. Which gives you a phenomena that may be so critical or important or play such a key role in how the deep ocean ecosystems function. That's only been recognized 40 to 50 years after the first real experiments and research went into looking to mine these nodules in the deep ocean, primarily in the Eastern Pacific Ocean, off the coast of, you know, between the coast, between Mexico and Hawaii.
The Clarion-Clipperton Zone, is that the
Clarion-Clipperton Zone, yeah, that's right, it's correct. Yeah, you know your business here. But seriously, I mean, we hear this argument all the time. We've gotten into the issue of deep-sea bed mining in the early 2010s. And you hear a lot of hype, a lot of misleading information coming from the companies, in particular the metals company, that are trying to pry open the international legal system to allow them to deep sea mine in the area, in the international areas of the world's oceans. And they, you know, they say, okay, we need these critical metals. For number one, when you mine mining for nodules, you get cobalt, copper, nickel, and manganese. There's no rare earths. There are rare earths in the nodules, but everybody recognizes they're not economically recoverable. And there's no lithium in the nodules. So it's just these four metals, three of which the mining companies that are trying to get permits to mine are looking to sell to the battery industry for making batteries for electric vehicles and home storage and utility storage and so forth. And they say, yes, of course, you know, there will be an impact, but it's going to be much less of an impact on biodiversity, on the environment, than mining, terrestrial mining for nickel, cobalt, copper, and manganese. And we have to make a choice as humanity. But the reality is it's a false choice. Because number three, there's a third choice, which is not mine these damaging, you know, conduct these damaging mining operations either on land or at sea for metals we don't even need to build the batteries. And I'm not just saying this, you know, speculating on this. We've seen a kind of a 0 to 40 transition in the last 5 years of the chemistries or the metals used in building electric batteries, batteries for electric vehicles. From lithium, manganese, cobalt, nickel, or lithium, manganese, cobalt, aluminum batteries to lithium, iron, phosphate batteries.
Right.
And they're substituting cobalt and nickel, which you either have to mine in the deep, well, not have to mine, but, you know, there's plenty of cobalt and nickel on land. The mining industry on land, however, for these two metals is quite damaging as well.
Yeah.
But at least you can see it, you can fix it. There is the possibility of reforming or improving terrestrial mining practices. But the bottom line is you don't need these metals to build batteries.
Right, iron, and there's the sodium ion battery.
And then you get sodium. You get rid of the lithium, and you know, phosphate, iron are in far greater abundance. You can source them from many parts of the world. The mining is likely to be much less damaging than it is when mining nickel in Indonesia or mining cobalt in the Congo.
Yeah,
but again, you know, we as society do have choices, whether as consumers, whether as companies with their ESG policies, their environment, social governance policies, or governments themselves in terms of investing in renewable technologies, investing in circular economies, reusing what we've already brought up, mining, opening up old tailings dams from previous mines that have been closed. So, for example, recently there's been an article out saying that the ash that's the leftover from coal mining and is laying around the U.S., you know, throughout the country in kind of piles next to these abandoned or even some still operating coal mines is actually a source of rare earths. And you don't need to worry about getting them from China if you can figure out how to mine these rare earth deposits that are no longer deposits. They're sitting in basically in garbage dumps and are easily accessible. So there are a lot of different ways to get the metals that are needed and the materials that are needed to transition to renewable energy economies without having to mine the deep sea or, for that matter, without having to conduct destructive mining operations on land.
Right. And there's also asteroid mining. Maybe that's in the future. We need a lot of capital for it, but asteroids have all the elements that we need and a lot of water as well.
Yeah, yeah, maybe we'll get Elon Musk up, building some space mining operations. Who knows?
And I am all for asteroid mining because if we have to mine, let it not be on the Earth.
That's right.
Because the seabed is very worrying because we have known risks, but we also have unknown risks, right? We don't know that much about it. Therefore, we need to take a precautionary approach. And I'm afraid that the intergovernmental body that's in charge of seabed mining has a conflicting mandate. Right. On the one hand, they're meant to develop this mining industry and they get, like 500,000 or something for every license. And then they also have the very contradictory aim of protecting the seabed.
That's right.
But then if you look at which aim they're really pursuing, in 2012, they designated 9 areas of protection. And then in 2021, another 4, I believe.
That's right.
All these areas that they're designating for protection are areas that coincidentally don't have much of these nodules. And they're also near the areas that do. And I'm no scientist, but if you're near an area that's going to have a lot of sediment, turbulation and all this, isn't that going to flow into the protected area? It's not like they have barricades.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, the actual amount that they're basically, these are no go areas. They're not protected areas. So you can't mine in these areas. These are the set of so-called areas of particular environmental interest that have been established in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and the nodule-rich provinces. It's an area of the deep seabed of about 4.5 million square kilometers. Maybe that's 2 million square miles. So it's a huge area. And the ISA has already, the International Seabed Authority has already issued 17 licenses for exploration that total about 1.2 million square kilometers or 500,000 square miles, all of which can be mined. There's no permission yet to mine the deep sea, but some of the companies and some of the countries that actually have these exploration claims through the International Seabed Authority are itching to get regulations in place so that they can apply for commercial mining licenses. But these mines would be huge. And they will not only impact the areas directly that mined, but they through plume flows and population dynamics and so-called ecological connectivity or species connectivity impact the organisms and the animals living even in these so-called protected areas. But beyond that, you know, scientists are saying that only a fraction of the animals that live on the bottom and even less than of the animals that live in the water column at depths of, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 meters, which equates to, 6,000, 12,000, 18,000 feet, are known. And there's a very real risk of species extinction, in part because of the intensity of the mining operations that would take place and the sheer size of these mining operations that would basically strip mine an area of the seabed per mining license, roughly of 100 to 200 square miles per year, continuously expanding across these 30,000 square mile claims over the course of a 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 year mining contract that they would get from the ISA. But coming back to the ISA, the International Seabed Authority, I'll use the acronym ISA. It was negotiated, the regime for mining the international areas of the world's oceans were negotiated in the 1970s and based on a number of foundational principles, some of which were quite visionary and quite progressive at the time. So, one of them is every country should have an opportunity to mine, not just the rich countries that had the money and the technological capacity to do so. And the United States at the time was talking up the interest and the commercial potential of deep seabed mining in the Eastern Pacific, in the international areas of the seabed, as a cover to try to bring up a Soviet sub that had sunk into the Clarion-Clipperton Zone with nuclear warheads on it. And I don't know if you've ever read the story, but it's quite a fascinating story. Howard Hughes and the Glomar Explorer that was built to be a mining ship, but actually it was built to try to raise this sub. And they were using, we're going to go out and explore for mineral resources in the deep ocean in the Eastern Pacific because of the huge potential monetary and commercial value of these these nodules. They also, the negotiators, were believed that there was a lot of money to be made by the collective nations of the world allowing countries and companies to go out into the international waters, the global commons, and pay royalties to the International Seabed Authority that then would be split up amongst all the countries that were members of the International Seabed Authority, which is to say all the countries that have ratified the Law of the Sea Convention. And developing countries in particular felt they were going to make a lot of money off this. This would be financially very beneficial to all countries, but in particular to developing countries. The third thing that they established as a key obligation in the seabed mining provisions of the Law of the Sea was that mining should be done without doing damage to the marine environment. Technically, they say the International Seabed Authority should only permit mining that ensures the effective protection of the marine environment from harmful effects of seabed mining activities and prevents damage to the flora and fauna of the marine environment. And it was because at that time, 50 years ago, the negotiators, scientific understanding of the deep sea was far less than it is today. And there was a general belief that it would be possible to mine the deep ocean without doing damage because there really wasn't all that much living down there. Cold, high pressure, inhospitable, dark, food poor environments. And as it turns out, the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and quite a few other areas of the deep sea are some of the most biologically diverse areas on our planet, and certainly in our oceans. They may not have a high abundance or biomass of species, but a very diverse array of species. And again, scientists are saying there's a very real possibility or risk that if seabed mining is allowed to go forward at the scale that would support commercial activities, there's a very real risk of extinction of species before we've even discovered them. And another thing that the negotiators established as a fundamental principle in the Law of the Sea Convention for seabed mining is that all mining should be done for the benefit of humankind as a whole, not for individual companies or countries, but all of us living on the planet and for future generations. And of course, species extinction is hardly a benefit for future generations. We shortchange them out of, you know, knowing or discovering portions of our planet that we may not yet be aware of. But more importantly, fast forward to 2024, where the ISA is now negotiating, you know, the contradiction in a number of these different assumptions and foundational principles of the seabed mining regime for the international areas of the oceans, and realizing that some of those assumptions made by negotiators in the 1970s no longer hold true or are valid, you know, they're now debating whether to move forward with mining at all.
Right.
And if so, under what conditions? And coming back to one of your original statements in this podcast, how do you balance the need to, you know, how do you address climate change without causing a biodiversity crisis problem? In other words, do you have to sacrifice ecosystems on our planet's high biodiversity areas in order to save us from the impact of climate change? I mean, you know, is it possible to prevent biodiversity loss and address climate change rather than making one problem worse in order, in an effort to potentially solve another area, another problem? But also, too, you have an increasing recognition at the international political level and at all levels of negotiations, we're losing biodiversity at an extraordinary rate. We're potentially going through the sixth mass extinction on the planet, which to me boggles the mind. You had a mass extinction event 250 million years ago. You had the Permian extinction. You had an extinction event in the 65 million years ago with the asteroid hits. We as humankind are creating in effect a geological catastrophe that the world has only gone through a handful of times. And I just find it extraordinary that we're doing it in the full knowledge that we are responsible for this particular extinction event. And so this has percolated up from the scientists to the policymakers, and you have a number of commitments now being made to halt and reverse biodiversity loss by 2030. This came out of meetings of the Convention on Biological Diversity, the so-called COP15 in Montreal in 2022. There's this thing, something called the Leaders' Pledge to halt biodiversity loss by 2030, which was signed by almost 100 heads of state around the world, including Joe Biden, as well as Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, and all heads of state of European Union countries, and a whole range of other countries as well. And deep mining the deep ocean would run fundamentally counter to those provisions, as well as provisions in the Law of the Sea Convention to protect and preserve the marine environment, to prevent harmful effects, etc. So that's kind of like the political crisis that's occurring in these negotiations. And we're trying to push countries in the direction of a moratorium. Say, wait a minute, slow down this juggernaut. You don't have to do that this simply because negotiators 50 years ago thought it was a good idea. You know, we can change the law if we have to, if it's no longer fit for purpose. But at the very least, negotiators at the ISA, take a pause, hit the pause button. Where do we get more science? Have a, you know, is it even possible to benefit humankind from mining the deep sea at all? Where are we going with circular economy initiatives? Let's look at the alternatives that are already out there and which we can benefit from, by not just in terms of protecting the ocean, but protecting biodiversity and ecosystems on land, rather than say, well, 50 years ago, negotiators thought this was a good idea, put it into international law, and now we have to do it. You know, there's nothing we can do. That's not true. You know, and when I say, you know, I hear this, for example, over here in Europe, I'm based in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. When I started talking to the European Commission about this 10 years ago, they were saying, well, it's inevitable. China's going to go mining. So we have to come up with regulations. And we, the Europeans, are going to be able to build the technology to mine sustainably. And we can force or demand regulations to make everybody else be able to mine to our high environmental standards. But it is inevitable. And I would respond and say, no, it's not inevitable. You, as members of the International Seabed Authority, have a vote, and you can vote no against deep seabed mining. You can vote pause the button against deep seabed mining. You don't have to do this. And I think what we're trying to do is hold countries accountable in these negotiations to say, you have political commitments, you have legal obligations. We're not asking you to do anything you've already committed to doing. We're asking you to actually do and deliver on those commitments, because civil society, you know, takes these commitments that have been made seriously, and we are going to try to hold the leadership to accountability to deliver on this, and not go out and destroy deep sea ecosystems across wide swathes of the deep sea and open ocean. But and you know, this is what we're trying to do today.
Thank you for doing that. It is a problem that we have all these grand commitments and then we don't actually do anything about it. But, you know, before you were saying, well, it boggles your mind, you're flabbergasted that we might die in another extinction, the sixth extinction, and that we caused it. But when you think about it, what about smoking? Humans still smoke today, and they know that it is going to give them cancer. They know it's terrible for them, and yet they continue to do it. You know, they get addicted. Like, we're addicted to this economy that we have, this fossil fuel economy, or the new energy transition economy. We're like, extraction is the answer. Oh, that previous extraction was bad. Let's extract something else. Extraction is the answer to our problem of extraction. I'm even in the same boat when I say, oh, let's go mine the asteroids. That's another extraction issue, right? It's the problem that we have as a species, I suppose, that we have to figure out how we can have these holistic answers that aren't just simply, let's just extract more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the statistics that just amazes me sometimes as well is the International Telecommunications Commission, I think it is, puts out periodic reports on electronic waste. Okay. And basically estimates that roughly 50 or more million tons of electronic waste are discarded every year, generated every year, of which less than 20% is actually recycled. Mm-hmm. And I remember having out in San Francisco, we had a big conference about deep seabed mining, and I was chairing a breakout group, and there was a CEO of a company that wants a deep sea bed mine, and there was a fellow from Apple. And the fellow from the deep sea bed mining company was trying to make the case that we need these metals to transition to renewable economies. And I said, well, you know, what about the recycling? I mean, and I cited the statistic. The guy from Apple, long and short, he said, well, gee, we should at least get the percentage of recycled material that's thrown away every year, material that's thrown away every year, and in terms of electronic waste, up to 80% before we even think about going out of the deep sea and mining. And again, it's, you know, one of the challenges and one of the things I can clearly see is that if the ISA opens the deep ocean to mining and billions of dollars pour in through investment by mining companies, countries build and operate these deep sea mines, it's going to be extremely difficult for the International Seabed Authority to roll that back. And if they are able to produce cheap metals, it's going to be almost impossible, you know, to stop the ever expanding scale and scope of deep sea bed mining. And rather than generate yet another throwaway economy, we need renewable materials use in the same way we're talking about renewable energy use, you know, not mining things, whether on land or at sea, that we use once and throw away into garbage dumps or electronic waste deposits, but make better use of what we have. And we can. These technologies to renew this stuff are available.
No, I vehemently agree. We need resilience in design. We need to stop planned obsolescence.
That's right.
We need recycling. And we could do this with regulative forcing to make sure that people have to recycle the batteries.
Yeah.
Some elements are easily recyclable, some aren't. But the elements that are, it makes no sense. Electronic waste is also highly damaging to the environment. It's toxic. So a circular economy, I think, is necessary. Even if it may not be sufficient, it is definitely necessary.
Absolutely. And it's doable.
And it's doable, yes. And the question that I have with deep sea mining as well, and the way that, well, hopefully it will never occur, but it was meant to be a space. So the seabed was designated as the global commons. And it was meant to be a space for developing countries to, as you were saying before, get this money. Now, the exploration licenses, they have to be sponsored by states, and they're all developing states. And you see these small Pacific nations. So I think it's Kiribati, Tonga, and Nauru that have these licenses, but I don't think they're going to get any money out of it. Firstly, that they're not even taking any tax, but even if they were, and we have this problem of regulatory arbitrage in any case where corporations are, oh, you're going to tax me, I'm going to get sponsored by this other state and so forth. And then with all the money that all these companies have actually wasted on their designs and promotion and blah, 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 I mean, they've never made actually any money, right? So when they go to file their taxes, wouldn't they just be saying, well, I haven't actually made any income yet. Look at all these losses. So what money is there for these states? And these are the states that are most in danger. They are facing a very concrete existential crisis with sea level rise.
That's right.
It is extinction for them. For us, it might be a severe change of life around the world. But for these Pacific Island nations, it is an existential crisis.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the reality is where there are published, where there is published information on the deal between the mining companies and, for example, the Pacific Island nations, the small island nations, Kiribati, Tonga, Nauru, and Cook Islands, the amount that of the revenue generated by deep sea bed mining would be very small, the percentage. Of that revenue would go to these countries as sponsoring states. As states sponsoring these companies for licenses with the ISA is very, very small. But you know what's interesting as well in this context is the idea was that they call it the common heritage of mankind, the International Seabed Area, And I mentioned that all countries should have the right to mine, etc. It was kind of hardwired into the Law of the Sea Convention on this, but what and that all countries should have an opportunity to mine. And there are provisions saying there should be no monopolization of ownership of these resources in the deep ocean. And yet, what we have today is 30 licenses issued by the International Seabed Authority, 30 contracts so far, of which 17 to 18 are in the hands of seven states: China, Russia, Japan, Korea, India, Germany, and France. And another 7 to 8 of those licenses are in the hands of roughly four companies: the Metals Company, together with a company called Allseas. There's a Belgian company called Global Sea Mineral Resources, and then there's a company called Loki in Norway. And what some of these companies have done is they've gone to developing states, and in particular small island developing states, because they know they're not going to pay much in taxes. They know a little bit of money will go a long way, because some of these states are financially strapped, and some of them have very small populations. Nauru has a population of 10,000 people. And the quid pro quo with the sponsoring state, well, the whole idea or obligation in the Law of the Sea Convention vis-a-vis the sponsoring state is that a state, a company needs a country that's a member of the ISA to sponsor it for a license. In exchange, that country can benefit from, you know, revenue by taxing or otherwise charging the company fees for getting it the license. But at the same time, that country, as the sponsoring state, also has to, is co-responsible for ensuring that the company abides by any regulations or any laws that are established by the ISA for mining, and that the country can exercise so-called effective control over the company. In other words, be able to penalize the company or fine the company or otherwise take action against the company for breaking the rules. And the Metals Company, for example, went to Nauru. Why? Because it's not going to cost them that much to get Nauru to sponsor them. They know that Nauru is not going to be able to exercise particularly effective control over the company, whose operations will be halfway across the other side of the Pacific. They know that, in particular, they can get access, they could get access and do get access to guaranteed nodule areas of the seabed without having to look for any nodules at all. And this has to do with certain advantages given to developing states to sponsor, to get into the mining business by setting aside areas that have already been surveyed by developed countries and are guaranteed to have mineral deposits. And fourth, in the TMC's case, I think they recognized or knew that it would be a lot easier for them to get now or to trigger the so-called two-year rule, which means should have meant that they could get a license within 2 years, even if regulations weren't in place, which they aren't. But in TMC's case, I think they overplayed their hand. And they got pretty bad advice from the Secretary General of the ISA, the International Seabed Authority, who was very pro mining. And, you know, we were set up to mine, and that's what we got to do. And there's no existential question about whether to mine or not. That was settled 50 years ago. We must mine, and so forth. You know, what's happened in the end, as I mentioned, is rather than these opportunities being spread out amongst a whole bunch of different countries, there's a concentration of essentially opportunity, ownership, and tenure in the hands of large global powers and northern-based companies using southern nations to get access, sponsorship for mineral deposits in the in our global commons. And so the whole
Matt, there's no moratorium in place right now, but the two-year rule, which they can't exercise, is that?
Well, no. Now we're triggered the two-year rule in 2021. So that two-year period expired in 2023, July 2023. And the idea is that if a country that's sponsoring a company, in this case, Nauru sponsoring the Metals Company, notifies the International Seabed Authority that its contractor, they're called, the company that sponsors, intends to apply for a mining license, then the ISA has 2 years to either adopt regulations in order that the application can go through under normal procedures and, right, you know, consistent with whatever regulations have been adopted by then, or if the council, the ISA rather, has not adopted regulations within 2 years, then the company could go ahead and apply for a license anyway, and the council has to consider giving it a provisional license under whatever provisional rules might apply, or if there are no rules adopted provisionally, then the general principles of the law of the sea. And what the countries, and this is where there is some hope that, you know, states are going to be starting to make more responsible decisions, are rethinking what was agreed 50 years ago and saying, we're not so sure we need to follow through on this or should follow through on this. At the conclusion of the two-year period that was triggered by NARO, primarily because the metals company needed to list on the stock exchange, it had to do a merger with a special acquisitions company, and they had 2 years to do it. And the clock was ticking on that merger process.
I see.
NARO triggered the two-year rule in July of 2021. TMC had until November of 2021 to make the merger with the special acquisition company. Otherwise, that company had to dissolve, and they would have to look for another company all over again to try to get on the NASDAQ stock exchange in order to start trying to attract investment into the company. But all that technical detail aside, what the ISA agreed at the end of the two-year rule was, you know what? Nobody should get a license until rules and regulations are in place in the first place. In spite of the fact that the law of the sea says, well, you should consider and provisionally approve an application after 2 years. And so countries are kind of reinterpreting the light of creatively interpreting some of the provisions of the Law of the Sea Convention in light of the realities of today, 2024, rather than the realities of the 1970s or the early 1990s when the two-year rule was negotiated. And that's a good sign. In addition, though, you mentioned moratorium. There are 169 countries that are members of the International Seabed Authority. And 32 of them have now come out calling for a moratorium. 2 years ago, none of them were calling for a moratorium. So this is something that's developed relatively recently, and in large part due to the campaigning that we as the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition and all of its members operating in a whole range of different countries have catalyzed, have made happen. You know, there were some countries already looking at this and thinking we need to try to slow this whole process down. But we really managed to get more countries on board, and that number, the calling for a moratorium, is likely to grow. And that's in itself delaying the adoption of regulations that would then open up the deep sea for applications for mining. And we're hoping to continue to build on that. We think more and more countries are starting to recognize this isn't a good idea right now. We don't have enough scientific information to know whether we can effectively protect the marine environment from harmful effects. That's a legal obligation under the law of the sea. And does the world really need these metals from the deep sea? And it's interesting because we're getting some, there was a debate in the British Parliament about this in 2019. And the Parliament basically concluded, this was a parliamentary committee on debate on seabed mining, and it issued a report called the Sustainable Seas Report on a variety of issues, one of which was deep seabed mining. And basically, they concluded three things. Number one, deep seabed mining will be severely damaging to the areas where the mining takes place. Number two, the ISA has an inherent conflict of interest, both as the regulator and as well as the protector of the environment, the issue you raised early on. In other words, they're going to depend on issuing mining licenses to actually fund the ISA, but at the same time, they're going to have to regulate the industry to prevent it from doing damage to the marine environment. Which way do you think that's going to go? And number three, they said, and the case that the world needs to mine these minerals in the deep sea has not yet been made. Yes, individual companies or countries can make money off this, but the world, the argument that the world needs these metals from the deep sea is not valid. It hasn't been proven yet.
Matt, one question: out of all the applications for exploration licenses, how many were rejected by the ISA?
Not a single one.
Not a single one. Well, that's very thorough.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, you know, we started going to the ISA, we as the coalition, we got observer status for the ISA meetings in 2014. So I've got 10 years of ISA meetings, council meetings, assembly meetings, workshops, et cetera, and so forth. And I think it was in 2016 or 2017. Poland, let's see, when did that application come in? I think it was probably 2017. Poland put in an application for an exploration licenses to mine hydrothermal vents along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. In an area south of the Azores, between the Azores Islands in the Atlantic Ocean and the equator, right off Brazil.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the areas that they put in an application for, you get basically 10,000 square kilometers, which is about what is it? That's about 4,000 square miles in 100 kilometer by 100. No, 10 kilometer by 10 kilometer squares. So you know you get a whole patch of kind of tenure over hydrothermal vents along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge for however many miles, you know, 20, 30, 50 miles, long. And one of the areas that they had got an exploration license for, a contract actually, was a so-called Lost City. And this is a very unique set of hydrothermal vents that some scientists are saying may be the type of vents that existed several billion years ago that actually are where life originated.
Right, life came from these vents, right?
and that area had been identified or classified as an area, what do they call it, an EBSA, an ecologically and biologically significant area, by the Convention on Biological Diversity. The ISA approval process didn't even know that that was an EBSA, much like how important that area was to science, and gave the exploration contract to Poland without even knowing it. And it was us that raised it in the meeting at which that exploration contract was approved, that license.
Wow.
Was approved. And we said, hey, wait a minute. You know, do you know where you're giving this license to? Do you know where, you know, this is an exploration license that could easily, be converted into an exploitation license, and you would destroy one of the most unique ecosystems of the series of very unique ecosystems, which are hydrothermal vents in the deep ocean. And you know, I was a co-author on a paper with a number of vent scientists as well as geologists and so forth, where we, a multidisciplinary group, a sociologist from MIT, was amongst the authors. And one of the things that we highlighted in the papers is these vents were only discovered in 1977. There are only about 50 square kilometers of these active hydrothermal vents in the entirety of the world's oceans. You could so easily destroy so much of that discovery, that unique area of life that opened mm-hmm. our minds and our understanding of the potential not only of life on Earth, but of life in the universe elsewhere.
Exactly.
You know, through seabed mining within 40 years of actually only having first discovered them in the first place. You know, and it's like, how can we destroy something like that, which we've only just discovered and that contains so many unique life forms, because somebody wants copper? And that's basically what these vents have: gold, silver, copper, and zinc. And our geologist basically concluded that if you mined all of these hydrothermal vents, these active hydrothermal vents, in the entirety of the world's oceans, you would basically be able to obtain a 1-year supply of copper that the world uses today. Sacrifice so much for so little. And again, you know, it's just the trade-off is so bad, especially when you take into consideration future generations and their ability to find new discoveries and new life forms in the deep sea, maybe find benefits for marine genetic resources for cures for cancer or cures for other diseases or products that we can make that would benefit humankind as a whole.
Wait, we've already done that, haven't we? Wasn't the PCR test from the sponges and there's medicine, painkillers, and antibiotics, and anti-cancer medication.
I'm not sure of the scope of things, but deep sea sponges, especially, are proving to be very, very interesting. You know, I mean, in part because these organisms, because they have to. They're called extremophiles, basically.
Extremophiles, yes.
environments, and so they produce enzymes and chemicals and so forth that either are very effective at and unique in warding off predators or surviving for decades or centuries or more in harsh environmental conditions that we can use to benefit us.
Now, Matt, in terms of Oh, sorry. What were you saying?
No, in just terms of shortchanging future generations of all of these potential benefits, these potential discoveries, these potential mind-opening vistas into life on our planet and elsewhere in the world for, you know, cobalt and copper and nickel that we don't need and would probably just be thrown away, used once and thrown away, because mining all this stuff would turn into a kind of perpetuate a throwaway society rather than a recycling society, a circular economy society.
Yeah.
And it's just, the trade-off is obvious to anybody with a reasonable look at what's at stake.
So in terms of, you know, digging ourselves out of holes, the ocean is the best carbon sink that we have in the world. And so now we're thinking, hey, why don't we just use engineering and make it an even better carbon sink?
Okay,
but that might lead to more problems, right? So there's sequestering, injecting carbon into the seabed. I don't know about leakage issues. And then there's increasing seaweed and other biomass, and also something to do with the electricity to increase the carbon uptake. But anyway, all these seem very risky, that actually we could disrupt the carbon sink that we have right now and make things worse.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, to do this geoengineering at scale that would actually draw down substantial amounts of carbon, assuming it actually worked, would result in very, very large scale impacts on the oceans, which may create feedback loops or actually produce the opposite result. So I was just in an event at the virtually, I didn't go there in Baku, but at the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention on Climate Change,
right,
Conference of Parties, the 29th Conference of Parties that took place last month, was it? Yes. Where there was a presentation from Woods Hole, a scientist at Woods Hole and Oceanographic Institute, one of the premier global oceanography institutes. And basically, they were looking at, they've been doing some research on the so-called mictophids or mesopelagic species. And these are species that live between, roughly speaking, 200 and 1,000 meters. So they're not on the seabed, but they would be impacted by deep seabed mining and geoengineering. And what they found, what they're estimating now, is a very crude estimate that the mesopelagic zone, through biological activity of the species in the mesopelagic zone, they could be sequestering between 2 and 6 billion tons of carbon per year. And that if you start interfering with it, and one of the big threats is in addition to kind of geoengineering using the oceans as an experiment to do so, but there's another threat on the horizon, which is actually fishing in this zone for so-called mictophids or anglerfish, the ones that you see with the teeth and the lantern off the top of their head and so forth, which are a keystone species basically in the zone. There are millions and millions of tons of these. You know, from the fisheries point of view, they're not looking at it in terms of individuals. They're looking at tonnage of fish that some in the commercial fishing industry are interested in because of to make fish meal and fish oil to grow farm salmon, basically, which again is a kind of a trade-off. You're just looking at a potentially disrupting a massive biological process ocean-wide to feed salmon. So that we can get cheap farm-raised salmon. I mean, this is, you know, these trade-offs. And geoengineering is the kind of thing that potentially threatens to backfire in a big way in the oceans. And so, you know, one can understand the real interest in trying to do something to draw down carbon out of the atmosphere. The big concern with that is that's going to basically let the fossil fuel industry off the hook. We're continuing to pump CO2 into the atmosphere, saying, well, yeah, we can just draw it back down. It might take 10 years or 50 years, but we'll do it. It could disrupt ocean ecosystems and functioning, including its capacity to act as a carbon sink.
Right.
And it detracts from actually taking the hard decisions that society needs to make, that our politicians need to take to basically hasten the conversion to renewable energy technologies.
Now, this fishing that you were talking about, is this down fishing? Because so many fisheries are on the brink of collapse. I think only 17% worldwide have any ability to increase their output. And particularly in some regions of the Atlantic, I think 95% of fisheries are near the brink of collapse and cannot be fished anymore. That is a startling fact that I think in 89, it was the high point of industrial fishing. 89. I mean, there's a lot of people in the world that are younger than that. It's startling to hear that. And so where are we at in terms of, so in Kunming, Montreal, in the Global Biodiversity Framework, they have this, there's the world commitment for 30 by 30. So 30% of the ocean should be protected by 2030. And 2030, we're kind of knocking on the door right now. So where are we at?
Well, the protection of 30%, they did, yeah, that we're way behind on that.
Yeah.
And you know, the question is whether that will actually occur by 2030 or not. It's an aspirational goal, and it's not a bad aspirational goal. But the last goal established by the Convention on Biological Diversity was 10% by 2020. And the world failed to meet that goal as well. But the more interesting thing, and certainly marine protected areas can help. There's a big question as to, well, is a marine protected area really a protected area, or is it just a paper park, you know? And that's, we've seen that happen. We've seen that happen in the world of deep sea fisheries, where states have said, okay, we're going to put 30% of our deep ocean ecosystem. This was the case for New Zealand in 2006. So we're going to put 30% of the deep ocean within our EEZ off limits. Actually, it was 31.5, I think, off limits to bottom trawling. But most of that was deep abyssal plane that will never be trawled ever because nobody can trawl down to 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 meters. And even if they could, there's not enough high enough concentrations of fish to actually make it economically viable. So it was largely a meaningless gesture, but they made that number 30%. Mm-hmm. In this case, that was the target for New Zealand on that. You know, they did protect a few areas that were productive for fisheries, but for the most part, it was areas that would never be fished anyway. So there's that concern. But the other concern is, well, what happens to the other 70%? And that was how I got into this, because I was actually, you know, the whole deep sea bed mining issue, I was invited into a science project funded by the European Union involving scientists from across Europe and brought in scientists from elsewhere in the world looking at the potential impacts of deep sea bed mining. And one of the objectives of that project, the scientists involved in that project, was to try to create this series of areas of particular environmental interest, these no-go areas that have been established by the ISA in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. And so we were looking at designing basically a 30% scenario along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge because of these hydrothermal vent deposits. And, you know, we were debating, okay, how big a buffer zone do you need around this? The scientists were saying we need to include representative areas of habitats and substrate and topography and biology and temperature and salinity and so forth and so on. So we capture representative habitats and so forth. And as we evolved, and this was like a 3 or 4 year thing, I started thinking, well, why are we arguing about whether we should protect 10% or 20% or 30% or 40%? Why aren't we discussing why would we lose any of the biodiversity in these areas?
Yeah.
And for who and for what reason? The question can't be how much are we willing to protect, but how much are we, if any, are we willing to lose or prepared to lose? And if so, why? Who's going to benefit from this? What's the trade-off? What's the benefit to humankind as a whole? And so that kind of took me out of, let's try to come up with good regulations for mining and make them environmentally friendly, because there aren't environmentally friendly regulations for deep sea bed mining. The damage will be severe, and the scale of the mining that needs to occur to make it commercially viable or even to be viable based on a return to the investment that a country would make to mine means that, you know, it will be very, well, severe damage and quite widespread. widespread geographically in terms of the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, widespread in terms of the extent of the available habitat in terms of mining for these hydrothermal vent deposits and vent ores. And so, coming back to your original question, I'm getting off on a tangent here, but it certainly, it's just you look at it from so many different angles, and it just doesn't make sense except for to a commercial operator that wants to make money, because mm-hmm. there are metals that are in high demand, at least for the moment, that they think that they can, extract out of the deep sea with the technologies they've developed so far, and make a nice profit.
So I want to ask you about the what's colloquially called the High Seas Agreement, or it's actually yep. the agreement under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea on the conservation of and sustainable use of marine biological diversity of the areas beyond national jurisdiction. Wow, that is a mouthful. No wonder we call it the High Seas Agreement. Yeah. And so I think it needs 60 ratifications, not signatures, to take effect, and we are not there yet. But what would this agreement do specifically with respect to the establishment of MPAs in an interconnected system of MPAs? How would that work? Are we going to get the 60 ratifications? Are we going to get it from countries that are able to enforce it?
Well, those are all good questions. I think we will get the 60 ratifications. The question is, how quickly will that occur?
Yeah.
It may be in the next year or two. It may take another 3 or 4 or 5 years, but ideally, or hopefully at least before the end of the decade, and potentially quite a few more. The question is, are you going to have the political mass, of countries to actually give it real effect? Are the big power nations or the big ocean nations going to stay out of that and try to ignore the process? I think eventually, though, they would have to get involved if enough other countries ratified the treaty. Will it establish a network of MPAs on the high seas? I think there's a good chance that it could. It won't have the legal authority to do so, but it does have the legal authority to commit states to doing so that have ratified the agreement as members of the bodies that do have the legal authorities to do so. So, for example, the High Seas Treaty would establish, basically an annual meeting of the members, the countries that had ratified. It would have a scientific and technical committee that would make recommendations based on science. And the idea is that if the annual meetings, assuming they're annual or the biannual, whatever the biennial, I guess, if it's every 2 years, that remains to be seen how they're going to do it, agrees that there needs to be an MPA in an area, then that would commit the countries that have, that are members that have ratified the High Seas Treaty and that are members of, for example, a High Seas Fisheries regulatory body, such as the North Pacific Fisheries Commission, to go into these bodies and basically adopt regulations to actually protect the area from fishing. And the same would happen, would ideally or occur with the members of, for example, the International Seabed Authority. They would be under a legal obligation to go into the International Seabed Authority and get an MPA in an area that the High Seas Treaty Organization had agreed that there should be one to protect it from the adverse impacts of mining, for example. So that's supposed to how it worked. But in addition, though, there are some other elements of that treaty that require, for example, extensive environmental impact assessments before new activities can occur in the ocean, such as geoengineering. And it could be a quite powerful tool to basically put the brakes on geoengineering unilateral efforts to geoengineer the ocean to try to enhance its carbon sequestration capacity, or even multilateral agreements to try to do that. And so, it has a lot of potential. The question is, will it deliver on what the treaty has designed the whole process to do. And again, it will take, you know, political will as much as it will take the legal provisions of it. And I say this from experience, because this High Seas Treaty is the so-called third implementing agreement of the Law of the Sea Convention. I was very much involved in the negotiation of the second implementing agreement of the Law of the Sea Convention, which is the United Nations Fish Stocks Agreement. Again, it has a very long name, and the short end is the UNFSA, basically.
Yeah.
And that has some very strong provisions in it. In part, it took fisheries conservation, the environmental components of fisheries obligations under international law, light years ahead of where they were in the original United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. And again, that was to a large extent a result of civil society participation in that process. You know, this process was one of the first sets of treaty negotiations at the global scale that was very much open to observers and civil society participation, because, you know, it occurred as a result of the Earth Summit in 1992, which very much opened up the UN system to observer status for, you know, indigenous groups and environmental organizations and other sorts of stakeholders in a big way. But what I've learned is that countries often will look at those treaty obligations and either ignore them or interpret them to mean something different than what they actually mean, or say, well, you know, glass half full. Okay, we're trying. We've partially implemented it. I mean, come on, this is really hard. Give us some credit. Or they'll basically lie and say, yes, of course we're implementing our obligations, when they're clearly not.
And so
just because it's international law, and there's a fellow named David Freestone who I've worked with. He's a professor of international law at Georgetown, but he was environment advisor to the World Bank for many years. And he says, just because it's international law doesn't mean it's going to happen. You really need to get the political will, and you need the civil society pressure to try to make it happen. And that's what we did with the bottom trawl issue in the high seas. You know, we took what was in international law and said, you, the countries that have ratified this, are allowing your boats to go out there and do something that's fundamentally in contravention of what you all agreed to through the UN Fish Stocks Agreement. You have to stop that. And we're going to the General Assembly to try to get the nations of the world to force you to stop, to meet your obligations under international law. And that's what it took. And we've actually had a lot of success with that, although we're still working for full implementation. But again, the point being, just because it's legally required doesn't mean states will actually do it.
Oh, yes. I mean, that is the problem with international law, right? Like, it's partly altruistic, partly imperial. It came from colonialism. The great grandfather of international law was actually counsel for the VOC, the Dutch East India Company. But anyway, that's a whole other tangent. Grotius.
Having international law on your side puts you at a huge advantage, but still, just because it's there doesn't mean it will be implemented. You need more. You know,
so. We need better enforcement. Matt, if I gave you a magical power right now to do whatever you could to protect the deep sea, what would you do?
Well, I would say I would probably stop all extraction in the deep ocean and say, let's set aside this part of the world for scientific research, to get a better understanding of life on our planet, to get a better understanding of how the ocean, regulates and contributes to a stable climate and overall well-being of the environment in which we need to survive, and do something in a bit like, you know, there's a precedent for this, like the Antarctic agreement, where in the 1980s, countries, the Antarctic Treaty Nations, came together to negotiate opening up the Antarctic continent to mining.
Yeah.
And they spent the better part of the 1980s negotiating the agreement, the treaty, to do so. And toward the end of the 1980s, first France and then Australia, or vice versa, said, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we should set aside Antarctic for peaceful purposes, for non-extractive purposes, for research purposes. And in the end, they prevailed. And so there was an agreement for a 50-year moratorium on any minerals extraction in Antarctica, and setting it and making it difficult to overturn that moratorium at the end of the, or renew it, I mean, sorry, to overturn it at the end of the 50 years through boating procedures adopted together with the moratorium. And you look back at that and you say, gee, how prescient that was, because now mm-hmm. Antarctica in the research and the scientific research being conducted in Antarctica is so critical to our understanding of the impacts of climate change and the impacts of, you know, past geological events, that if they happen again because of us pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, are going to make life very difficult for everybody, not just in particular, but not only for the small island developing states. You know, if sea level rise goes up 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet, which it has in the past. And so I think the same is true of the deep sea. It's a global commons. We don't need to exploit it. There, the handful of deep sea fisheries produce virtually nothing in terms of contribution to global food supplies. And to the extent that they do, they're mostly fish for the European, U.S. and Japanese market. And the same is going to be true for the deep sea bed mining. And so why should we destroy these areas? Why can't we learn from these parts of our planet? Why can't we learn from our past mistakes? You know, cutting down the Pacific Northwest forest was considered to be, you know, a boon, a great economic opportunity in the 1800s and the 1900s. Now we realize, boy, that was a mistake. We lost, you know, and, you know, if we had known then what we know now, we would have been a lot more cautious about it. And again, I think the same applies to the deep sea. And because legally nobody owns it, nobody has the right to go out and do what they want there. They have to do it with the express consent of the international community through, you know, the ISA in the case of mining, through these regional fisheries treaty organizations in the case of fishing. You know, it would be a lot more responsible and a lot more beneficial to all of us on the planet to, you know, direct that funding and those efforts at management and the cost of all that management toward basic scientific research rather than trying to spend money to figure out a way to exploit what's down there. And that's, that would be what I would do with my magic.
Agreed. And you don't even need magic for that. We just need willpower.
That's right. Yeah, political will, and it's growing. You know, political will is growing. But you know, the question is, it's going to be. And again, our fear is, if the ISA opens the ocean, the deep sea to mining, and the first goers get licenses and prove profitable, a lot of money will pile into that industry. The big companies will buy out the wildcatters. More states will get involved. And it will be almost impossible. The economics of that industry will drive its development, and it will be very, very difficult for the ISA, which is already a weak regulator, to be able to prevent the runaway development of the industry.
Well, hopefully that would never happen. And also, if we look at destructive industries, a lot of them rely on subsidies, right? Even fossil fuels to this day relies on subsidies. Industrial fishing relies on subsidies. And so get rid of destructive subsidies. I mean, just let economics take its course. But we've covered a lot. But I was wondering, is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to discuss?
You know, on the economic side of things, there are big question marks as to whether it's even economically viable. And so that's, you know, a positive sign. But there's also the issue of if the deep sea bed mining goes forward, whether the ISA itself might operate at a loss for reasons I won't go into. It's kind of difficult to explain. But there are provisions in the law of the sea which would require it to operate at a loss, which again may mean the whole project would be unviable economically, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Right. But I do think, you know, with deep sea bed mining in particular, we wouldn't. First of all, it will be a lot easier, however hard it may be, to prevent something from happening in the first place, rather than to try to walk it back once it begins. And so I'm a bit optimistic, cautiously optimistic that the nations, you know, the majority of the nations that are involved in the International Seabed Authority that have ratified the Law of the Sea Convention will take their responsibilities seriously, will take their responsibilities to, you know, protect the environment seriously and so forth, and make a good decision. And although that won't solve a problem, it will prevent a problem from happening. The fact that the nations of the world could collectively make a responsible decision to protect our environment for future generations, to maintain or restore the health of deep sea ecosystems, prohibiting the trawling, the deep water trawling on seamounts and so forth. It can give us some hope for the future that, you know, the world, however, diverse and problematic the leadership may be, is capable of making good decisions that will help us and future generations get through the next century or two with our environment more or less intact. And, you know, the Montreal Protocol that prevented the use of fluorocarbons is cited as CFCs, an example of something that, that the world could come together and make a good decision on this. And I'm hopeful that if the members of the ISA do this, it's going to bode well for future decision-making in recognition of biodiversity loss, in recognition of the need to reverse biodiversity loss, in recognition of the need to fight climate change without destroying large areas of our environment, and give us now and ideally future generations some hope for our ability to recognize problems that we've made ourselves and be able to correct them.
Right, and stop banging our head against the wall and just repeating the same mistakes. So, Matt, one last question for our audience at home. If they want to help the deep sea, what do you suggest that they do?
Well, talk to your local politicians. Demand that they act, that and that can be effective. I mean, even under the current circumstances in the United States, you had recently California ban deep water mining. They call it hard middle mining in state waters. Okay, that's not a huge area, but there are these metals there. Oregon has already adopted a provision like that, a regulation like that. Washington State has done so. Hawaii did it most recently, just earlier this year, I believe it was. The politicians will react. And even if it may be more difficult at the federal level, there is state level action that can be taken here in the U.S., or there in the U.S., I should say. I'm in the Netherlands, but I'm from the U.S. originally. And sign petitions and, support environmental organizations that are advocating for this, get companies to agree not to source metals from the deep sea. And already there's some real good movement there. Apple has come out saying we won't source metals from the deep sea. Microsoft has said we will keep deep sea metals out of our supply chains. Google has come out in supporting a moratorium. Rivian has done the same, and so forth. But I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier that I meant to say last. You said we call it Earth, and yet 2/3 of our planet and 95% of the biosphere is actually water and ocean water at that. There are cultures, indigenous cultures in the Pacific, that are actually very much ocean looking. They call it, some call it Moana. This is what the earth is. It's primarily water. But there are groups we work with in Hawaii that say, I'm paraphrasing this. I'm not an expert on this, and I'm not attempting to give a definitive kind of statement as to what they say. But basically, they're saying our origin story is the deep ocean. That life began there, and then it kind of gradually came to the surface and then climbed up the mountains and then evolved into the sky. And to us, deep sea bed mining is basically an abuse of our culture. And I've been in conversations between the metals company and representatives from Hawaii, and they say, who gives you permission to mine in our deep sea? You do not have our permission to do this. And so it's a cultural affront to them in a very fundamental way because of their relationship with the ocean that many of us terrestrial dwellers simply don't have. It's beach, it's surfing, it's sailing, but it's not the origin of life itself, in terms of...
But it is scientifically the origin of life itself. Yeah.
But an even deeper relationship, because the cultural relationship with the deep ocean is part of the overall ocean environment. So, again, there is that element of it. And like there is a growing recognition of the need to halt and reverse biodiversity loss, there's also a growing recognition in the international political negotiating sphere of the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples and local communities. I mean, and they are very active at the ISA, communities from the Pacific, but also, you know, indigenous groups from around the world that have kind of come out calling for a moratorium on deep seabed mining, demanding that their rights be respected, their cultural rights and their cultural heritage being respected, as well as, you know, the environment and all the other associated issues surrounding deep seabed mining.
And they are the strongest voice around the world for environmental protection and the preservation of biodiversity. And then, and unfortunately, even terrestrial mining mostly targets indigenous territories.
That's
because
right.
have lithium and cobalt and so forth. In the U.S., all lithium deposits are within 25 miles of indigenous territories. So we are perpetuating historic injustices with this rapacious extraction strategy. Yep. Well, Matt, thank you so much for your time and insight today. Very much appreciate it.
Oh, Alexander, my pleasure. And thanks for the invitation to come on your podcast and talk about this. And it's really important, I think, that people understand and realize and recognize what's actually happening and the kinds of big decisions that the world is poised to make.
I hope you have found this podcast insightful and will join us next time as we explore more issues affecting our environment and human rights at home and around the world. For more materials on this issue, please go to our website, thegravity.fm.